On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Housing starts may be way down, but you could see the political framework for the fall campaign season going up like gangbusters this week. President Bush, front and center, banging away on national security, on detainees and Guantanamo, on surveillance and war and threat, while the Baghdad morgue tripled its body count and New York Times pro-war columnist Tom Friedman accused the Bush administration of moral confusion. It's been a lively week back from Labor Day. Ford steps aside at Ford. Couric sits on the anchor desk. New oil, thank God, in the Gulf. Agassi and Irwin go down fighting. Up next on Point, Dana Milbank of The Washington Post, Kim Strassel of The Wall Street Journal, our own Jack Beatty, and you on The Week. We have a terrific panel with us this hour. Joining me from Washington is Dana Milbank, national political reporter for The Washington Post. He writes the Washington Sketch column. He covered the White House during President Bush's first term. Dana Milbank, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Kimberly Strassel, member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board. Today's lead editorial is Interrogation and Intelligence. Kim Strassel, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Dana, and Kim.
Let's go straight to it. Dana, what's your top-of-the-week story?
Well, there can be no doubt that President Bush sort of regained the megaphone with his switch on both the closing of the black site prisons in Europe, moving the people to Guantanamo, and issuing the new interrogation orders for the military. This sort of set back the Democrats, who had been expecting to make a different line of attack, and also put on their heels John McCain, Lindsey Graham, the Republican mavericks who had been challenging the president in the Congress. So it makes it much more likely he's going to get what he wants in terms of these tribunals through the Congress this year. Also gets him back on the terrorism issue, which is where he wants to be, not talking about Iraq or health care or high gas prices, that sort of thing.
Dana, is national security still a political slam dunk for this White House, for the GOP?
Not a slam dunk, but it's about the only shot that works at this point. Not getting credit for good things happening in the economy, but getting blame for high gas prices, for a lack of health coverage. Iraq is clearly turned against the president, and that's the leading issue here. So it's not necessarily a winner, but it's the best hand they have.
Pay no attention to that rumble of other issues behind the curtain. Kim Strassel, what's at the top of your list?
Well, I mean, I was with Dana. At the top of my list was this news conference that the president had, the speech saying that he was not only acknowledging these secret prisons, but going to bring back these guys to America for justice. And I agree with Dana. This is good news for the Republicans. It helps them to be on this issue in the run-up to the election. But also, I thought that what came out of that speech was fascinating because we got a lot more information about how these facilities work. Turns out that they were actually pretty impressive. They've actually yielded a lot of information. And as people start talking about 9/11 and the anniversary here, you know, I think you could make a good point that one of the reasons the country hasn't been attacked again maybe will be because of what they've gained from these secret facilities.
Come home, America, to the national security issue. Jack, what's got you going this week?
The agreement that President Musharraf reached with his tribes in North Waziristan, brings home to us, it seems to me, 5 years after 9/11, the mocking circularity of events. The South Asia Times runs the headline, Pakistan, hello Al-Qaeda, goodbye America.
That is kind of a peace deal with Al-Qaeda within its borders.
That's right. That's right. And what we're beginning to see is what we had before September 11th, a Pakistan-protected enclave, this time not in Afghanistan, but within Pakistan itself. Of course, we give Pakistan something like $4 billion in aid, plus credits, plus other things. So this entire cycle for 5 years, from a safe haven in Afghanistan, now we have the safe haven building in Pakistan with the blessing of the Pakistani president, who's our client.
So top story, and you take us all the way out to Waziristan. I guess it's the circularity you're pointing to as the big issue behind that. How do you see that, Jack?
Well, I mean, what have we succeeded in? I mean, if in fact bin Laden is protected now there in a way that he hasn't been before, and he can continue to do his operations from there, what have we accomplished in this 5-year fight against him? It's a very disturbing event, it seems to me, and of course the State Department is to say they're angry about it. I'm sure that's privately what they must be saying, but that's the fact.
Kim, Dana, how about it? A great big circle here. Kim, what do you say to that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, this is something where we just aren't sure yet what's actually going to come out of this agreement. You know, we have had some cooperation. We have been in there and looking for things. And again, go back to these secret facilities. One of the things that's interesting is the president talked about, for instance, how catching various al-Qaeda guys and then getting them to release information allowed them to catch yet other ones. And that was some of the interesting declassified information that came out of his speech the other day. It also allowed us to put together a lot of information about how al-Qaeda operates. These people were able to identify voices on telephones. They were able to confirm details about financial transfers. And this has given us a much better sense of how the entire operation works. And so, yeah, we still need cooperation from governments out there to be able to get in and find people, but with that much better position to actually find them when we need to.
Here's the president saying the U.S. has to hold and interrogate.
To win the war on terror, we must be able to detain, question, and when appropriate, prosecute terrorists captured here in America and on the battlefields around the world.
Dana Milbank, what about that list of interrogation nuggets that the president talked about having pulled out of terrorists this week? He says that here's a sign of progress, a sign that it's working, a sign we need to keep on doing this. Jack looks all the way to Waziristan and says, we're in a big national security circle here. You might look to, I don't know, the bloodshed in Baghdad and say something like the same thing. Circle might be the best thing you can say about Baghdad. How do you see the overall progress?
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that, but interrogation-wise, first of all, I mean, the president made some concessions for the Pentagon, but notably did not make such concessions for the CIA, which apparently can still do things like waterboarding and the dogs and the temperature extremes and the hoods and the nudity, whatever else was going on in the Abu Ghraib environment. The only quibble I'd have with Jack's overall look is that I think it's not terribly new that that Pakistan is something of a safe haven, and that's been a constant problem all along. And there's this perpetual balance with Musharraf that if we don't keep him there, the alternative is worse. We're going to have a Mujahideen with nukes, and that would be a lot worse than whatever concessions are being made to al-Qaeda in the north. But certainly, you know, the president's out there this week saying we are safer, we are not yet safe, which certainly suits him during this election time. The Democrats are now out there saying we're not any safer at all. It's, of course, very hard to gauge this, but I think what everybody's coming to agreement on is that the adventure in Iraq has certainly not improved the overall national security.
Democrats going after Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld this week. Here's Senator Charles Schumer saying Rumsfeld doesn't have what's needed to head the Pentagon.
To fight a war on terror, you need to be both strong and smart. And with Secretary Rumsfeld in this administration, you do see a great deal of strength, but you don't see enough of the smarts.
GOP headed off a no-confidence vote. John McCain came out and endorsed Rumsfeld, saying any president should be able to pick his own team and at least endorse that.
President should be able to keep that team until such time as the President of the United States loses confidence in that team.
Kim Strassel, what about the Democrats' attack here on Rummy on the overall direction of national security progress? Does it have traction?
You know, look, this is the Rumsfeld attacks in particular are a way of nibbling around the edges. The Democrats are having difficulties at the moment because they don't really know what their position on Iraq should be. Should you cut and run? Should you withdraw? Should you have phased withdrawal? There are many different ideas out there, and they're on the defensive, too, because they have struggled over the years to convince the American public that they should trust them on national security. So Rumsfeld is an easy way to get into this. You complain about the way the war has been prosecuted, and you single this guy out. And interestingly, they've actually gotten a little bit of traction from Republicans, too, especially those that are running in tough elections. They don't want to come out and actually complain about the entire Iraq war. They don't want to say bad things about their president. But if you come out and instead say, I agree we should have gone to Iraq, I don't like the way it was prosecuted, and that's Rumsfeld's fault, that's what a lot of them are saying. Now, the thing that strikes me that's fascinating about this is that what none of these people seem to understand is that the president is incredibly loyal to his staff, and the more these attacks increase, the less likely he is ever to get rid of Rumsfeld.
Here's Democratic Senator Joe Biden back on national security on ABC's This Week, saying American voters are smarter than to buy into what the GOP and administration have been selling them on security front.
I think the key question is not are we at war, are we winning this war? Are we safer today than we were 5 years ago? And what we're going to do to make us safer 5 years from now? And on that score, I think the American people are beginning to see through the charade here.
Jack Beatty, I quoted Tom Friedman earlier at the top of the hour. He says Bush has got and Rumsfeld have deep moral confusion. An important end, and of course, Tom Friedman was for going to war, but not the means to do it. He says President Bush summoned us to D-Day and gave us the moral equivalent of the invasion of Panama. But they're large and in charge on the stump right now. Do you think Americans are going to go with that again?
Well, according to the latest poll, 51% say that Iraq should be the top priority for the president and the Congress, as against 12% who say energy, the economy, and 9% who say terrorism. So Iraq is salient above all other issues, and it is a total negative for the president. The strongest line, it seems to me, for the Democrats, Kim says they don't have a plan. Well, no, they don't. But there is such a thing in American government as accountability. And anyone who thinks this war has been competently conducted simply isn't in touch with reality. And that issue, which centers around Rumsfeld, but which also goes right to the president and right to what Tom Friedman was saying, that we never had enough troops for this right from the start, that is an issue, I think, that that has a lot more traction to cut against the president's effort to say the Democrats want to cut and run.
Dana Milbank, take us into the political metaphysics here. The polls are very bad on Iraq, and the news from Iraq still not good by the military's own assessment on many fronts in this last week. So can the Republicans, sort of stand tall rhetorically on national security, sort of bring on the macho face of determination and win, even if some of the facts on the ground look awfully grim?
Well, it depends on what winning is. I mean,
November elections?
A best case scenario for the Republicans right now is they keep control of the House, but still lose something like 10 seats and have an ungovernable majority there. Same thing in the Senate; they only lose a few seats. Worst case for the Republicans is they actually lose control of the House, and in the most disastrous scenario, control of the Senate as well. Everybody is talking about large gains for the Democrats. It's really a question of how large the gains are here. So Kim was talking about the Democrats being on the defensive, and in some particular areas they may be, but in large part this is one of those unusual moments when the Republicans have been the ones playing the defense here, and all of this standing up posturing on national security will work to some extent because that is, as I said earlier, the best hand that they have to play. The problem is it seems to have a little bit less effect each time it's brought out, the notion of the election is approaching and we should start worrying about terrorists.
Kim Strassel, how about it? Political theater meets worldly reality. Can the Republicans still play this card effectively? Say, look, yes, we've made some mistakes, but we've got your national security interest deeper in our heart than the Democrats. Does it still work?
Yeah, I think what Republicans, you're going to see them do, not just through this upcoming legislative session, but especially when they quit and they go home to do the last push before the election, is they understand that their problem is going to be making sure that voters don't view this as a referendum on them. and on their leadership. Because if that's what this race is about in the end, they will lose, and they'll lose the House and maybe the Senate. Because there are a lot of even their own Republican base that are very unhappy, not just with the war, but with their spending, with their lack of progress on other key issues. So what they're going to be doing out there is saying, look, this is a choice. Don't make this about how well we've done it, but let's make it about what you're going to get if we leave. And you're going to see a lot of that happening because they're going to argue, yeah, maybe the Iraq war isn't going fantastically. But, you know, if you put Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, there may be a cut and run, and that will be worse because, you know, Iraq will only get worse and it will become a haven for terrorists, and we can't allow that to happen. So that's what you're going to see them doing out in this upcoming election season.
Listeners, what's at the top of your list this week? 800-423-TALK. Cornelia's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Cornelia.
Hi. Yes, Ms. Stoffel said that we got all this valuable information from these terrorists that have been transferred back to the United States. But how do we really know that? The president has said that. But, of course, all this is classified. So the whole concept of classified information really contradicts the principle of an informed electorate. How can there be democracy when voters are systematically denied the facts under this cloud of classified information?
Well, I mean, surely you'd agree sometimes things need to be secret, Cornelia, but are you going deeper to the president's credibility? Are you saying you don't believe him even when he says it's true?
Yes, basically.
Kim Strassel?
Well, I mean, I think, look, this is a president who is under so much scrutiny and heat from human rights groups and other things. And, you know, if there is stuff that's gone on that he hasn't said, or if he were to lie to the American people, it would probably come out in the end. So I don't necessarily think that is what's going on. You know, and the details he gave were pretty persuasive. He talked about getting Abu Zubaydah, who later revealed information about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and where to find him. KSM, in turn, gave information about where to find the guy that masterminded the Bali bombings. So there does seem to be a link. There does seem to be some pretty concrete information about the secrets that these guys have yielded up and how that's helped us to understand Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, Jack, I hear you gasping there.
Well, yeah, but in today's times, they go right through these things. They go and they find that, in fact, in most of these claims that he made, these were things already known, already on the record, even in the September 11th Commission report.
That doesn't make them untrue.
It doesn't make them untrue, but it doesn't make them these startling and hugely helpful revelations, and we mustn't forget how they were got from these people. Ron Susskind's book, The 1% Doctrine, leaves no doubt, and I don't know that it's been refuted, that these people were tortured. Oh, the president didn't use torture. And by the way, I don't think a president of the United States has ever come closer to being attached to that label or even using words that could periphrastically be interpreted to be torture as Mr. Bush did. This is really something. I mean, one of these men was not only beaten and waterboarded, but when that didn't work, he was told that they were going to kill his children. This is our people doing this to another human being. it's very difficult, it seems to me, to have a president of the United States defending that as some great triumph.
But from the beginning, and again this week, the president's basically suggesting we will do what we have to do. But Dana Milbeck, to Cornelia's question from South Carolina, she says, you know, there's this skepticism issue and the credibility issue. Let's just go to the president's basic statement. He said again this week, we do not torture. Dana Milbeck, do you believe that, or is there a three-card Monty game going on in these new regulations?
Well, there's always been a distinction between torture and other coercive methods, so that's something of a semantic game here. But
the president says it, and I mean, doesn't have to mean something. It's not just surrounded by a fudge
now,
line.
Here we come to the larger question of the president's credibility, which has slipped considerably in the polls, and that's a problem. I mean, I think all of us can agree that even in a democracy, you need a certain amount of secrecy and classified information because you don't want that to get to your enemies. That's perfectly reasonable. What's happened here is because of the the WMD in Iraq because of hints of an al-Qaeda Iraq link, the president's credibility has gone down. So you're having people like the caller really doubting most anything probably that's coming out of the president's mouth right now. And this has damaged him. It damaged him very much politically. You know what? I don't want to get into a guessing game of when the president is or is not telling the truth. We're not going to try to get into his mindset, other than to try to determine with the way we can report what is actually true or not.
But the GOP saying clearly they believe the whole effort since 9/11 is working. Here's Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Senate Majority Whip. It is working.
So far, since 9/11, and we'll be commemorating the fifth anniversary here very shortly, America has been secure here at home as a result of our policies of being on offense, as well as strengthening our defense here at home.
Kathleen's calling from Brewster, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathleen. What do you see out there?
Oh, Tom, don't get me started. I was just thinking this is probably the least scrutinized administration I've ever seen. I don't know where we... where that comment came from. What I see when Kim was talking about what they have to offer the Republicans, what they have to offer is, if it's the best they can do to offer a secret prisons, that's charming. Also, there was a story that didn't get any press this week that my brother sent me about the approval of using cluster bombs that we make that kill more women and children than anyone else. And, you know, these kind of things are just going unattended. Whereas, and what else will we get? We'll get George Bush quoting Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, but what about when the president says, we'll do what we have to do to defend this country? And if that means tough interrogation, we'll do it. And if it means cluster bombs to win a war, we'll do it. What's your reply to the president, Kathleen?
I feel like I've never been less wanting to be associated with America than at this moment, not because of the American people, not because of our soldiers, not because of any of that, because of this absolutely sinister administration.
Kathleen, thanks for your call. Kim Strassel, you hear what Kathleen thinks. Newt Gingrich, we read today in your newspaper or yesterday on the op-ed page saying, on to World War III. It's on and we need it. Let's recognize it. Let's go. These are we don't want to beat the polarization drum unnecessarily, but these are very, very polar views of the world.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me, I mean, Jack was talking about how we got this information from these people. But I think the thing that the president was trying to say and what everyone might keep in mind, too, is who are these people? And let's remember, these are guys who long ago violated any normal rules of war. You know, that's why they're unlawful enemy combatants, because they killed women and children. They ran airplanes or masterminded the running of airplanes into buildings so that there's a giant hole in New York City at the moment. And yes, there are many different definitions of what counts as torture. And these guys probably weren't getting, you know, brownies and candy canes out in this secret prison. However, they were probably subject to some pretty tough investigations and interrogations. But this is the sort of thing that the president was saying that you might have to do in order for us to stay one step ahead of these guys. The people we're talking about out in these secret facilities are very rough characters. They're some of the nastiest people on the face of the earth at the moment.
And now they're at Guantanamo, and so the argument for closing Guantanamo becomes much tougher, kind of a political masterstroke in a way there. Let's take a call from North Augusta, South Carolina. Ryan is on the air. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I was wondering whether or not this the Jack 2 well that they just got working in the Gulf is really going to brighten oil futures, or if it's just going to offset some of the issues we're having up in Prudhoe Bay.
Let us pick it up. Dana, Kim, what do you know about the Jack 2 well? This is the very deep well in the Gulf of Mexico. Is it Chevron, I think, that says they may have a very big discovery there? I think there was some movement in the price of oil this week on that. How big a deal, Dana?
Well, it's potentially huge in that it is at the high end increases known U.S. reserves by 50%, which is huge. I think the remarkable thing politically is how quickly everybody breathes a sigh of relief and we can go back to our oil addiction and never mind about that whole global warming thing. You could see the relief spreading not only in the markets but across the country.
Kim, are you looking there for for real relief? Do you have any question that oil's out there? Do you see the dynamic in oil prices headed down as we move toward the November election?
What was fascinating about the Chevron news this week was that it was the second example in recent weeks of the fact that U.S. oil production does have a big influence on prices. You know, this is something that a lot of people on the left, for instance, for many years has suggested was not the case. You talked about opening up Anwar, and they said, oh, it's only 1 million barrels of oil a day. That's nothing. It won't influence prices. It's anything. It's a drop in the oil bucket. But, you know, what you have was Prudhoe Bay shut down a couple of weeks ago because of this oil issue.
The pipeline problems there, the leakage, yep.
Yeah, the pipeline problems and leakage. That was only 400,000 barrels of oil a day, and prices jumped dramatically on the news. Now you've got the news about Chevron, and prices fell, too. We're talking about a tight oil market. Any information about a new supply does have an effect on prices, and this should actually make a difference in the upcoming legislative season because there's going to be a lot of discussions about offshore drilling. Both the House and the Senate have passed bills. Now they're going into conference to decide exactly how to reconcile those. They're very different bills. The House is much more aggressive than the Senate's. But the news that there is plentiful oil and natural gas off the coast may well factor into those discussions.
Jack Beatty, fossil fuels back here with a vengeance. And just as Kim says, and Dana, you know, this kind of funny contradictory reaction, give me my oil, save us from global warming at the same time.
Yeah, it's an equivocal triumph, isn't it? Just as people are getting used to the idea that we're going to have, $3 a gallon gas for the foreseeable future, along comes this seeming deus ex machina.
On Tuesday, Katie Couric stepped into the anchor chair at CBS, made a little history of her own there as a woman, and she reached right out to the viewers for a little help.
If you have a bright idea for a great sign-off, log on to our website at cbsnews.com and tell me. I know we'll have a lot of fun reading them, and who knows, maybe one will actually stick.
Who knows? We'll talk about Katie. Let's go first to Aaron in Monticello, Iowa. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to make a comment about what a lot of these Republicans and Democrats, because a lot of them voted for this war, too, and, of course, they're not going to make light of that now. But the problem with this war is, you know, we've been over there for so long, we're making no progress, and they say if we leave, it's going to be a haven for terrorists. It's already a haven for terrorists. And the day we leave, I don't care what kind of government Americans help set up, it's going to be total chaos when we leave because that terrorist element over there that hates America will not support that government.
Aaron, we've got it. There's a dim view from the heartland, and thanks very much for calling. Let's get another call from New Haven, Connecticut. Doug's on the air. Hi, Doug.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that it's very important as a democracy at this point that we learn how to discuss the goals and the strategies of a war. I lived through the Vietnam era, and there we just were stuck in a dialogue between let's pull out and let's support the president. And I think we need to have a fundamental discussion at this point between everybody about what the goals are for Iraq, what we are going to do to try and accomplish those goals, how much it'll cost, and how much we're willing to commit.
Doug, let me ask you. You just heard Aaron say he doesn't believe it's going to work in Iraq either way. Do you think we're stuck in a Vietnam style, black white quandary again here? Pull out or support the president, or is the country already beyond that?
I think the president is pushing us into that. I think he's attempting to label the Democrats the defeatocrats, and I think he's talking with such platitudes, such as we're going to stay the course, or we need to stand up against terrorists, that he's obscuring and cutting off any discussion because we need to push him. We need to say, Mr. President, what exactly is your plan?
Yep.
There has to be more to a plan than we're going to stay the course. We're going to stand up till the Iraqis can stand up, and then we'll stand down.
Doug, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. Dana Milbank, how about it? Is the political season going to pull the country's conversation with itself, as Doug suggests, back into a simplistic box, appeasement versus stout-heartedness?
Oh, clearly. I think what's interesting from your callers is you're getting a nice sense of the anger that's out there and that is likely to cause this backlash against Republicans on November 7th. But it's and how it is very much centered around Iraq right now. And that issue does seem to be breaking through, even when, the chattering conversation moves on to issues of black site prisons or of interrogation techniques. There seems to be a growing consensus in the country that that Iraq is a bad situation, and we're really debating what is the worst option in terms of more bloodshed, a departure of the troops or remaining of the troops. But as you were indicating, there's no chance of that sort of a debate occurring before the election. This is strictly a time for posturing and mischaracterizing the other guy. It's doubtful we're ever going to have that kind of a debate, but it's certainly not going to occur right now.
Well, we'll try it right here. Jack?
Yeah, well, and it's clearer and clearer that the course that we're on is babysitting a civil war. David Ignatius of the Washington Post, been on our show a lot, just came back from Iraq, and he toured it, and he said there's just no question in his mind that it's in a civil war. We have the population now. People are taking out Shiites, are getting their names changed to have separate IDs to make them look like Sunnis. People are hiding their license plates if they drive to the north because they have the Iraqi flag on them, and the Kurds don't want that. There was a fracas in the Iraqi parliament over the whole issue of autonomy with
federalism.
Yes. And meanwhile, we have a prime minister there who's supported by a militia that his own troops engaged in battle a week or 10 days ago. And, you know, wait a minute now. Whose side is he on? I mean, is he going to confront the militia, or is he with what is the Iraqi army anyway? Look, more and more, we're dealing in a situation here of almost unfathomable hazard for our troops.
Kim Strassel, let me turn to you here. You're on the Wall Street Journal editorial board. You're hearing these calls coming in today, the anger Dana Milbank points to. At the Wall Street Journal editorial board, you guys were pretty big in helping set the agenda for a lot of things in the last few years. Do you talk about, do you feel a national mood turning against the stripes of your editorial posture? Honest question, with respect.
Well, look, I think that there are a lot of Americans out there. Yeah, there is some definite frustration about what's happening in Iraq. But you got to go back again to why we're there in the first place. This talks a little bit, it gets into the Bush Doctrine, as it's now being called. And remember, the original choice was, are we going to sit here in the United States and hole up and wait for these guys to come back and try it again? Or are we going to go over there and make a start in transforming this region?
Were those really the only options? Hole up or go to war? I mean, I think I heard some middle ground. Go out
there
and
may
police.
Have been, but I mean, if you're thinking the grand big thoughts out there, which was, you know, where are these guys coming from? What is this anger that's directed toward us? Why do they have all these safe havens? And it's because there's a region over there that is extremely undemocratic, where these guys can work at their will, and where their goals fundamentally are to take over the governments, many of these places, if they haven't already. So the question was, do you go over there and start a very big project? And the decision was yes, first Afghanistan and then Iraq, and the hope was to set up a few democratic governments, which with any luck would spread to surrounding areas.
Now, have we gone over, messed it up and made it worse, or are you still hopeful?
Oh, very hopeful. You know, this is certainly, I mean, yes, there's some big problems in Iraq, but I would imagine in the long term, if you can hold on in the long term, and this was always going to happen, there was always going to be a point, you were never going to change Iraq overnight. So there was always going to be a long period where there was some issues, and how do you actually create a democracy in a place that's never really had one before? And the president probably knew those risks, and it's now coming out to get him in an election year. But if you're looking at it in the long term, fundamentally, you have to think that giving millions of people the opportunity to vote for the first time, have a constitution, and have some kind of normalcy in their life, if and when we can fix some of the terrorist issues, that this is a good thing in the long run.
Kim Strassel hanging in with the original view there. Jody's calling from Boston. Hi, Jody. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling concerning Katie Couric.
Sure.
I'm thrilled as a woman that she has made it to the place where she is.
Top chair in the network, evening news, the anchor.
Absolutely,
the anchor.
It's wonderful. However, I truly believe that the changes in the show and the manner in which she is reporting the news lacks gravitas, and I hate saying this.
Do you have to have basso profundo to have gravitas?
Gravitas, yes.
I mean, but do you have to have a big male voice to deliver that? Is that what you're saying, or it's Katie's style?
I do not. Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. So what is it? What's the problem?
I find this silliness of, you know, what am I going to say at the end, everyone? And, let's talk to the man in the street. Darling, it is not a morning show. This is the time when people get, many people in this country, get serious news about what is happening in the world. It ought to be delivered with what Woody Allen used to call high seriosity by a person with some dignity.
We're happy to have you say that with a sense of humor at the same time. Kim Strassel, Jody wants gravity from Katie Couric. You know, in a way, it's just showbiz, but it is how a lot of Americans still get their news. What do you think? And does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, she makes a really good point. Well, one of the reasons Americans love Katie Couric and why she did so well in the morning show is because she is a very personable person, and she's fun, and people feel as though they identify with her some. But there was always going to be this question when she went off to go do the high seriosity news program, how that would transfer. And I think you heard from your caller that there are some people that, you know, they still have in their mind Walter Cronkite. They want these kind of guys who look very serious, look in the camera, and give it to them straight.
But what do you think? As a woman, is it an offense to the seriousness of the national dialogue to have Katie Couric-style delivery, or does it get right to the heart of things somehow?
I think that I prefer that people to get right to the heart of things. But then again, I never watched the morning TV program, and I probably won't watch many of Katie Couric's evening newscasts either.
All news to you, all new to you. Dana Milbank, what do you think? Katie's in the chair. She's got nearly a third, I guess, of the evening news audience. What does it say about the health of the American news business and, I don't know, the national dialogue?
Oh, that's just the beginning of it. You've got Tucker Carlson from MSNBC going on Dancing with the Stars. And then you've got Tom DeLay coming out for one of his opponents because Jerry Springer's also on the show. Look, I mean, the evening news is no longer what it was. It still has huge audience, but nothing like what it used to be. They're going through the same problems that we in the newspaper business are going through, in magazines, and it's this whole fragmented market, and we're just scrambling to figure out how to stay alive here. So I think there's an ambivalence in the public. They would like to get a lot of serious news, but nobody's willing to pay for it anymore, and you can't have it both ways.
Jack Beattie, what do you think? Are we pulling the, fuzzy covers of warm Katie Couric over our heads? You know, sort of hiding out from the news here? Or is this what it takes to break through the stentorian tone and get to what really matters?
Well, you know, I didn't get a chance to see the broadcast, but I read about it, and it sounded as if she was also bringing some of the best of the morning show to the evening, which is to say newsmaker interviews and interviews with opinion leaders. You mentioned Tom Friedman. I think he made those comments on her with an interview with her. That seems to me an effort on the part of the broadcast to bring in something like commentary within its own borders.
Well, they had Rush Limbaugh last night saying we must defeat Islamic fascism.
It seems to me that's all to the good, to bring in a variety of opinion, not just here's the news, but here's an analysis of the news, here's an opinion about the news, react to it. It's good showbiz, and it also helps people understand things, because when people have an opinion maker gives an opinion, it brings together lots of things and can crystallize inchoate views for listeners.
Well, there will be a big microscope on the variety of that opinion that's offered. AJ is calling from Potsdam, New York. Hi, AJ. You're on the air.
Greetings. I'd like to weigh in on the issue of Bush's environmental stewardship vis-a-vis a question of morality. And I think it was best said when I read an obit years ago of the great American the dean of desert naturalists, Edmund Yeager, who appeared at a gathering at which also appeared Bertram Russell. And the question of right and wrong, capital R, capital W, came up. And after a fashion, Yeager turned to Russell and said, "The environment, since it cannot run away nor defend itself, must be protected. And that, sir, is the difference between what is right and what is wrong." Or as Nick Kristof in the Times this week, a couple of days ago, ended his op-ed piece, he said, "Mr. Bush's mistake in Iraq may not matter anymore in 100 years, but our wilderness heritage lost on his watch can never be restored."
So are you seeing abuse or something upheld this week? Or are you saying in general on the environment?
Yes to all. His abuse, his mishandling of it, his absolute wanton, savage abandonment of any type of stewardship is breathtaking. It's as if this bunch came to power and said, "We're going to get back at all those green peoples and their silly ideas of things like conservation and protecting wilderness and
AJ, we've got it. Jack, let me turn to you. There's such a torrent, I lose track. But someone I'm just reading in this last week was saying, you know, Al Gore and global warming is all great. But you know what? The Islamo-fascists are coming at us a lot faster than the tide. I mean, it's hard to know where to put priorities lately.
It is. I've been reading a book about pessimism and, you know, the history of pessimism. And my God, the case for pessimism, if you think about global warming, has never been stronger. The trouble is, it's just hard to relate to the news every day. And yet, this is something like a fuse hanging over, you know, lighting to the future of the planet. And yet it's very hard to make it politically saleable, as Gore himself learned in the 2000 campaign, when he pretty much dropped the issue because he couldn't cut through with it.
Yep. We're not giving up, though, pessimism or not. Agassi didn't give up this week. Kim Strasser, you were watching that match, I think. What a right-to-the-end effort.
Yeah, I just thought that this was such a wonderful end performance. You know, Americans have been so taken with Andre Agassi, and I really think it's because Americans watch this guy grow up, not just literally, but figuratively, too. You know, here's a guy who everyone remembers the flamboyant clothes, the wild hair, the rebellious attitude, and then the failed marriage, and then falling down the ranks. And here's this guy who picked himself up. American loves these success stories. He got his life back in order. He climbed back up the rankings again. He's now got this brilliant family. He, in his off time, he does charitable work with these schools for underprivileged kids. And there he was out on the court, his last match. He was in extreme pain. He fought it out all the way to the very end and gave this incredibly moving speech. The whole thing was really a class act.
Couldn't quite take the last one, but he went out a winner. Even so, let's listen.
"You have given me your shoulders to stand on, to reach for my dreams. Dreams I could have never reached without you."
Dana Milbank, you're going to take some encouragement from that kind of performance?
Well, certainly not from my tennis game.
He'll whip you to the end, huh?
Oh, indeed.
Oh, boy. It's been great to have all of you with us this hour. Dana Milbank, national political reporter at The Washington Post, has the Washington Sketch column there, and it's terrific. Author of Smash Mouth. Dana, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Kimberly Strassel, member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Great to have you with us, Kim.
Thanks again.
And Jack Beatty, good to have you. Here we go off to the weekend before 9/11. I remember the silence of the skies on the days after 9/11, sitting at soccer games with the kids, no planes overhead. Kind of spooky feeling comes back again as we approach Monday.
Yes, 5 years and 5 years for this program, too.
We'll talk more about 9/11 this weekend and on Monday. Jack, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.